in spiral stage of the neutron star, you'll see the coalescence to a central massive object, which in this case collapses rather rapidly to a black hole. But there's two things I want you to focus your attention on. One is the fact that there is some matter that has so much angular momentum that it's not immediately being able to incorporate into the black hole. It forms a disk around the black hole. And the second thing I want you to note is that there are tidal forces during the merger that can produce these tails, basically matter that's either ejected entirely from the system or at least flung out to very eccentric orbits, which only bring it back to the black hole long after everything else down here is basically finished. So there's really two types of counterparts that I think are the most promising to associate with these events. The first is the idea of a short-duration gamma-ray burst. This idea has been around for a while. It's basically just that this disk that forms as it accretes onto the black hole, through some way we're not entirely confident of, produces a relativistic jet, and that relativistic jet itself produces the GRB. It's very difficult to calculate a GRB from first principles, as you might imagine. It depends on uncertain things such as what fraction of the, even if you can estimate the accretion rate onto the black hole, you have to know what fraction of it goes into a relativistic jet. We generally think that the energy of the gamma ray burst is related to how much mass accretes, which in turn is probably related to how massive this disk is. And that's in principle something we can get at through these simulations. But even if you get that, to produce a GRB, you not only need an energetic outflow, you also need an ultra-relativistic outflow. So you have to avoid entraining this jet with too many baryons. And this depends on microphysics, I think. It depends on things like, you know, with what rate are neutrinos driving mass from this torus, and how many of them are being entrained in the jet. These probably depend on both the microphysical heating and also the microphysical mixing going on. And although these events are ideal candidates as electromagnetic counterparts, they're bright and very easily detectable out to the edge of advanced LIGO. One disadvantage is we think they're beamed into a fairly narrow solid angle on the sky. So only if you happen to be looking down the barrel of the jet will you actually observe a GRB. And if you're off axis even just a bit, you may not observe any high energy emission. So this leads me to what I think is a perhaps more promising counterpart to be associated with all gravitational wave signals, and that's the idea of a thermal transient powered by the radioactive decay of ejecta. So if we eject some matter from the event, it's neutron-rich. As we discussed earlier, it will form heavy elements. And those elements are radioactive, so they'll continue to heat the ejecta and can power something like a supernova. It's dimmer than this event, but more isotropic. And this, and as I'll show this in turn, being able to determine the properties of this kilonova depends on how much mass is ejected, with what speed, what's its composition, and how hot is it. And also the details of the nucleosynthesis, and even things like the radio transfer through these exotic nuclei, photon radio transfer. But one of the things I want to emphasize today is that these things are actually connected. At late times, the accretion rate onto the black hole can actually be affected by the heat released by the R process. And likewise, the accretion disk itself can produce outflows, which in turn augment the amount of ejected mass ejected from these systems. So I'm going to first talk a little bit about short gamma ray bursts. So just to remind you, we're focusing on this remnant torus. So there have been a variety of numerical simulations studying the formations of these disks. I've just listed a few of them here. And depending on things like what's the mass ratio of the system, how sophisticated of general relativity you include, what's the equation of state you assume, people find that this disk can have a wide range of masses. Importantly, these disks form very hot. So all of the complex nuclei, at least initially, are broken down mostly into free neutrons and protons. And these disks are very dense, so they can't really cool through photon emission, but they can and do cool through neutrinos. These accretion disks that form are neutron-rich. Their composition, the neutron-to-proton ratio, is generally set by, at least when they're neutrino-transparent, is set by a competition between electron and positron captures. And because these disks are moderately degenerate, it turns out this reaction wins, and it drives the composition to be neutron-rich. So using simple prescriptions like alpha viscosity, you can estimate what accretion rate this matter accretes onto the black hole, and it's very high, up to several solar masses per second. So to accrete, say, half of that mass at this rate, you have a typical accretion time scale less than about a second. So it's really these two facts, this very high accretion power and this duration, which naturally comes out to be a fraction of a second, that is why we associate with short GRBs. among other evidence that's now been accumulated by the Swiss satellite. So one of the things I want to emphasize about accretion disks is that they not only accrete, if they have a fixed mass reservoir initially, they actually spread outwards in radius. So I'm going to show you this simulation of the magnetorotational instability in this torus by Holly and Balbus. And you'll see the development of turbulence in the disk and a lot of exciting things happening down here. But what I want you to focus on is the outer edge of the disk is with time spreading to larger radius. And this is just a consequence of angular momentum conservation. Even though turbulence can redistribute angular momentum, more or less the total angular momentum of the disk is conserved. So if its mass goes down, its lever arm radius or mean radius must increase. So accretion of these remnant disks naturally leads to expansion to larger radii. So we studied this using a very simplistic model because it turned out to be, it's already computationally demanding to follow this for many, many viscous times, so this can be done. But to get at the essence of this, we looked at a height-integrated one-dimensional model. So if you have angular momentum and mass conservation, that leads to a diffusion equation for the surface density of the disk, and we assumed an alpha viscosity. You have to solve for how thick the disk is, which requires evolving the entropy evolution. So the heating is primarily due to the dissipation of viscosity in the disk, so it's just turbulent heating. And cooling is through neutrinos. And we also followed the evolution of the electron fraction in the disk, which, as I said, is dominated by these electron and positron rates. So you'll just see, this is just a little movie of the spreading disk. It's just in one dimension now. So this is the local disk mass versus radius. And you'll just see that with time, the disk mass goes down and it spreads to larger radius. So after about a second of evolution, the outer edge of the disk has reached several thousand kilometers. And although this is a one-dimensional simulation, it just follows from angular momentum conservation, so this spreading is fairly robust. And if you follow the accretion rate onto the black hole, it's initially roughly constant for the initial accretion time scale, and then it asymptotes to a power law, t to the minus 4/3 at late times. There are actually three phases of accretion that this disk goes through. When it's initially formed, it can have a very high accretion rate, so high that even matter may be able to accrete before it's able to cool. So this is like a neutrino trap regime. And during this phase, the disk is thick. Here I show the cooling rate over the heating rate kind of at the location where the mass is peaked versus time after the merger. So initially, cooling is much less than heating because matter is being evected into the black hole. But then there comes an intermediate phase where the mass loss has, mdot has gone down, and it's able to cool into a fairly thin disk. Heating is roughly able to balance cooling, and this is where you get the highest efficiency of neutrino luminosity. And then at late times, the temperature drops enough that the neutrino cooling becomes ineffective. Even though it's transparent to neutrinos, the cooling is just not able to keep up with the viscous heating, and so the disk puffs up again. But there's also something very interesting that happens at late times, and that's that we believe the disk evaporates. And this is for the following reason. So as I showed you, after a fraction of a second, the disk spreads to, say, 500 or 1,000 kilometers, its outer edge. And the temperature in the disk drops to below about 1 MeV. At this point, something interesting happens. The free nuclei in the disk recombine into helium initially. And this releases about 7 MeV per nucleon. It's a very fast reaction. It's just limited by your usual deuterium bottleneck type thing. So once you reach conditions to produce it, you produce it fairly effectively. And this exceeds the binding energy of the disk to the black hole. And furthermore, the disk it can't cool itself through neutrinos anymore, so this inevitably leads to powerful outflows that basically blow apart the disk at late times. This was actually confirmed through a series of 2D simulations by William Lee and collaborators. But using our 1D simulations, we just estimated that maybe a third of the initial disk's mass will be re-ejected in these winds as it evaporates by the nuclear energy released. And so if you track the accretion rate onto the black hole without any outflows, it can be relatively high and decline slowly, but without flows, it drops fairly rapidly. So in order to determine the composition of this matter ejected in the evaporating disk, you have to follow its freeze-out in the disk itself, because the weak interactions are initially fast, but as this disk is freezing, they're becoming slower, and at some point, it freezes out. So I'll again show you a movie of the electron fraction, the solid line here, and the dotted line is what it would be if it were in equilibrium with these rates, which are controlling its evolution. And the line here just shows you where the mass of the disk is peaked as a function of time. And you'll just see that as time goes on, the disk is spreading, but the electron fraction is dropping below the equilibrium fraction. So I should just go back to the beginning for a second and say, initially when the disk forms, the inner part is all in equilibrium. The outer part is not, but there's no mass there. But as time goes on, the place where the peak of the mass is freezing out. And I should say that most of the evolution calculations of these disks to date in multi-dimensions assume some type of equilibrium like this. But it's clearly becoming invalid at late times as the disk is becoming cool, as it is becoming cooler. And so both thickening and freeze out of the disk begin on the outer edge and move inwards, and then it will start to evaporate. Yeah, that's where the mass of the disk peaks, because I'm showing you electron fraction. See, so yeah, so that's just showing you that at this point in time, so if I stop it at this point in time, after it's at 10 to the 8 centimeters, this entire region where all the mass has peaked is all frozen out. So it's kind of analogous to, you know, Big Bang nucleosynthesis or something. Alpha part. Yeah, so that's happening at the edge here. We didn't include that in the simulation because we were inferring that it was happening after the freeze-out. So the idea is that the freeze-out happens first, and then immediately, or very soon thereafter, you start forming alpha particles, and the disk starts evaporating from the outer edge inwards. But we think we can have a simulation without the heating from alpha particles because the freeze-out starts first, but this should definitely be further explored. And so you can do things like calculate what the final YE distribution is, and you find a range of YE from fairly low values at the outer edge to somewhat higher values. But this is, again, just a one-dimensional simulation. One of the big mysteries associated with short gamma ray bursts that is underappreciated is the fact that many of them are not so short. In addition to the gamma ray burst itself, which are these little spikes, many of them are followed by these very bright tails of X-ray emission. This is seen in about a fourth of the swift gamma ray bursts, but may be present in up to a half of them. The rapid variability of these tails strongly indicate that they're a result of ongoing central engine activity. So if the gamma ray burst is powered by black hole accretion, the black hole must still be accreting 30 or 100 seconds after the gamma ray burst. And this is disturbing because if you calculate the energy released in these tails, and sometimes it exceeds the gamma ray burst itself and can be up to 30 times greater. So this is a big mystery because we would like to associate, as I mentioned before, this gamma ray burst with the accretion of this disk, which I showed you didn't last for more than a second. But now we have a huge amount of emission coming out at late times. So what's the origin of this? Well, one explanation, if we want to stay within the merger or the paradigm of neutron star mergers, is that you have some matter that's falling back to the black hole at very late times. I already showed you these tidal tails, matter that may be flung out to very eccentric orbits. And this has been looked at by several authors. What Stefan Rozwag did is just calculated, took the output of his SPH calculations and estimated when particles would come back to the black hole and tracked the accretion rate. And he found that at late times, this is seconds, this is the fallback rate, it asymptoted to a power law. And although there's no hint that there's some, you know, gap and rise in this, there was in principle sufficient accretion power at 100 or 1,000 seconds in his models that you maybe could explain these flares if there was some reason to trigger them. But Stefan's calculations of the fallback are missing some important physics that was already described, and that's of the R process. As this material that's going out is decompressing from nuclear densities, as Jim and others showed a while ago, it will undergo the R process. Basically, what happens is you have fairly neutron-rich matter, but as it expands, the protons combine with some of the neutrons fairly rapidly to produce fairly heavy, A of 100 or so nuclei. But there are so many neutrons that there are many left over, and they can only be incorporated in these nuclei by subsequent neutron captures. And as we already described, this works by neutron captures and beta decays. And we looked at the R process in neutron star merger ejecta using the nuclear reaction network developed by Gabriel and Almudena, which includes a variety of the relevant reactions. For matter that was completely unbound from the system, so an unbound trajectory, we found that it produced elements peaking at kind of the second and third R process peaks. But for right now, and I'll come back to this, the unbound ejecta, but for right now, I want to emphasize the fact that the R process is exothermic under these conditions. It releases energy. Basically, if you're taking free nucleons and putting them into nuclei, that releases energy of order 1 to 3 MeV per nucleon, so fairly significant. But importantly, it's not released instantaneously as matter is expanding. It's released over a fairly long time scale because you have to wait for these beta decays to occur. You're limited by weak interactions, and so the heating occurs over kind of second time scales. So it's more like you have neutron fuel that you're using up. to kind of gradually heat your matter. And that has an important, potentially important effect on its impact. So one thing we did was to look at the effects very crudely of our process heating on fallback just by calculating the Haar process heating along various Lagrangian trajectories corresponding to orbits with different semi-major axes. So we looked at very short orbits that return to the black hole on 0.1 seconds and also very long orbits that return on 10 seconds. So these are the density trajectories we assumed. And as matter expands, of course, it initially cools, but then at some point the R process heating, which is shown here for the various trajectories, kicks in and you start heating up again. For the short orbits, they return to the black hole before they've used up all their neutrons. But for longer orbits, they're able to use up all the neutrons, and it takes a few seconds. And then for those, they get no more heating after that point. So if you look at the total amount of heating received by these trajectories versus their orbital period, that's shown with these points here, this is for different assumptions about precisely the solid angle of the expanding ejecta. For short orbital periods, they don't have much time to heat. But for longer orbital periods, you get more and more heating. It's more or less linear. And there comes a critical orbital period of about a second where you get so much heating that you're exceeding the binding energy of this orbit to the black hole. And so it's very clear that the R process heating is going to have a dynamical influence on whether this material is able to return to the black hole, because it's heating it above the escape speed in some sense. So we have not yet incorporated this into a hydrodynamic simulation. We just wanted to point out this fact, and we're working on that currently in a way to make this feasible to put into a hydrodynamic simulation. But we did look at a kinematic model, so just said, what happens if I heat little elements of particles, and if they receive enough heating to exceed the binding energy that we kick them out? If not, they return to the black hole. What effect does this have on the late-time fallback accretion? And what we found is that this depended on how long it took the R process lasted. There's a critical orbital period of 1 second where the R process heating is enough to unbound the ejecta. So this is, again, just various trajectories. If the heating was longer than about a second, we found that the effect was that it completely cut off the tail. So you have a runaway process where matter heats up, and then if it heats up, of course, it goes into a longer period orbit, which gives it more time to heat, and there's kind of a runaway. In our expansion of, in our thermodynamics, but not in this toy model. We can talk about it, but it's not necessarily incorporated in this toy model. And the other thing we found was is that if the heating time scale was fairly short, what the effect was instead, you could open up a gap. And I don't want to put too much on this, but you know, there's a possibility that this could be an explanation for why some gamma bursts have no tails and why others do. In the simple model, it depended on this critical parameter, which depended on the mass of the black hole and how much energy released by the R process, and this heating time scale. And all of these, if this number, I think, was much greater than one, then we found no tail, much less than one. And really, it kind of goes through the range of parameters. So it's not implausible, but this is just a place where I want to emphasize that the R process is affecting what we observe in the X-rays, potentially. And so this is a place where it does have an important effect on what we observe. So I want to now move on to this idea of the kilonova, which, as I said, is the matter that's completely unbound, which may be augmented from outflows from the disk or from this R process heating of the trajectory. As we already discussed, there are various sources of neutron-rich ejecta. There can be dynamically ejected material during the merger itself. Groups tend to disagree, I think, currently on how much matter can be ejected. It seems to me, in my simple-minded view of this, it seems to me that the full GR simulations tend to find less ejected mass. Newtonian simulations tend to find quite a bit more in some cases. And there are apparently people that are working to bridge this gap and by including both to more accurately determine how much mass is ejected. We also have potentially even more mass being ejected from this accretion disk, both through neutrino-driven outflows, which I have not discussed, and also this thermonuclear evaporation of the disk. And this, I think, can contribute comparable or greater than amount than is dynamically ejected. And as I showed you, this is also fairly neutron-rich. So the idea of these R-process-powered supernova goes, I think, back to Burbage, Hoyle, and Fowler in a paper prior to their famous paper in the 50s, where they initially proposed that type 1 supernova were powered by the decay of californium-254, presumably because they thought that such our process nuclei could be produced in supernova. Of course, today we don't think that type 1a supernova are powered by something like this. We think it's instead nickel and cobalt. But this idea that the R process elements could power supernova was pointed out again by Lee and Paczynski associated with these mergers. The basic idea, as I said, is that these nuclei you produce are radioactive. So as this matter is expanding away from the merger site, initially it's releasing a lot of heat, but it's all being lost to adiabatic expansion because the photons can't get out. But then you reach a point where the photon diffusion time scale is equal to the expansion time scale. And this is where the light curve of this event can peak. And this depends on how much mass is ejected and how fast it's ejected. But it's typically about a day for these events, so much shorter than a normal supernova. But the important thing is if you want to know how bright these events are, you not only have to know this, you have to know how much heating the events receive on this time scale of one day, which depends on which nuclei are decaying at this time scale of one day. And in Lee and Paczynski's model, they left this as an F parameter, some fraction of the rest mass of the ejecta, which they didn't specify and could have varied by three orders of magnitude, either making these much brighter than normal supernova or much dimmer and impossible to detect. So what we did was to basically calculate this radioactive heating, focusing in on this F parameter. So this is the radioactive heating rate. So this is for matter it's ejected entirely. This is the heating rate versus time. You get all of this heating at early times. This is where all the heating is dominated during the R process itself, but then you produce all these nuclei and they decay over time. This is a superposition of many, many hundreds of decaying nuclei. And we find that it actually generally obeys kind of a power law decay, kind of similar to radioactive waste, which should be contrasted with nickel and cobalt decay, which is kind of flat until the decay time scale. And on these time scales of one day, which are relevant for the mergers, we find a decay of something like T to the minus 1.2. But the dominant nuclei contributing are much different than nickel. They're strange isotopes of iodine, tellurium, xenon, and antimony. And we found that this was, as Almudena already discussed, fairly robust to our assumptions. We tried different electron fractions, which, as I showed you, could be different nuclear mass models. And we believe that this result is also probably relatively insensitive to outflow trajectories, and it agrees with recent results by Luke Roberts and collaborators. So we put this radioactive heating into a Monte Carlo radiative transfer code to calculate how the photons are streaming out, producing a light curve as the matter is heated. So here I show the luminosity of the bolometric luminosity versus time. These events tend to peak on a time scale, as I mentioned, of about one day. We found that their peak luminosities for a typical ejected mass of, say, 10 to the minus 2 solar masses is about 1,000 times brighter than a nova, but dimmer than a supernova. So we term them kilonova. We were also, to some extent, able to calculate the color evolution of these events, so what matter is getting out in various wave bands. Unfortunately, we are limited by the fact that the opacity for this ejecta, which is basically pure R process elements, is not well known. The opacity in supernova ejecta is a blend of many lines, most of which are not known for these elements. So we're only able to assume iron opacity, and this gave us some color evolution. But this is a major unsolved question. What does a pure photosphere of R process elements look like? It's expanding at a tenth the speed of light. I think this is something we need to continue to think about. So there's a potential, I just want to say very quickly, that there are a few ways you could go about detecting these events, which I think make them promising. One is as a follow-up to a gravitational wave trigger. So if LIGO sees an event, it will triangulate its signal, LIGO, Advanced LIGO, Virgo, these arrays of coming interferometers, and we'll be able to triangulate and produce an error box on the sky. And if you were able to pan that error box at the edge of the Advanced LIGO volume, this would correspond to a visual magnitude you need to get to 22 to 24. But the unfortunate thing is that these error boxes will be very large on the sky. So you need a telescope that's big and has a wide field of view. But there is one coming on the next decade. It's the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. So there's really important impetus to figure out what these events are doing so that we can inform how LSST should be panning the sky to find these. Not that that's their only science objective, but there's some urgency here. And also the fact you may look for these events after short gamma ray bursts. The problem here is that the afterglow tends to be very bright. I just show you very quickly these are various optical detections after short gamma ray bursts. This is just how luminous the gamma ray burst is. So people see a gamma ray burst, they point telescope, measure the optical emission. And versus time after the burst. And all of these dark squares here focus on those are detections. And these models are the kilonova light curves. In general, the detections are much brighter than the kilonova light curves. And this is because most likely we're seeing the optical afterglow, the non-thermal emission from the jet, not this thermal emission from the heated R process ejecta. But nonetheless, there are some cases where we're reaching similar magnitudes. And so there's a possibility, if the afterglow is particularly weak in an event, that we could detect this event. And I'll very briefly say that we actually had a candidate event that we thought was one of these gamma-ray bursts that very rapidly faded in its afterglow emission, but then rebrightened in the optical emission. Unfortunately, we looked for the host galaxy of this event to confirm the kilonova model, which is shown here with orange, and there was no galaxy there. And we don't know if this was a merger that was kicked out of the galaxy, and that's why it had such a dim afterglow. We think the afterglow is related to how dense the circumstellar environment is. Maybe this was a cruel coincidence that it went off in some low-density pocket of intergalactic space, which allowed us to detect the kilonova, but does not allow us to confirm the galaxy. So these are a challenge. But the final thing I'll say is there was some discussion earlier of the origin of the R-process elements. And much like type 1a supernova inform our understanding of where iron comes from in the universe, and core collapse supernova inform our understanding of where calcium comes in the universe, et cetera, these events could inform our understanding of where the R-process comes. If we detect them, then basically their luminosity is proportional to how much ejecta is being dispersed into space. And so you could get a rate for how much the interstellar medium is being polluted by mergers. So to remind everyone, we don't know where half these elements come from. People think they may be core collapse supernova, but as was described, that theory doesn't work particularly well. But if you fix if we know how much R process is produced in the galaxy, and we take an optimistic rate for the rate of mergers, then that basically fixes how many of these events should be detected by future surveys. But as I say, this is hinged upon these surveys shortening their cadence so that they could have a good chance of detecting these events. So I just want to wrap together my conclusion. So sorry, it's wordy here. Nuclear energy is released following mergers as matter expands to lower densities. Depending when and where this occurs, this can have an important and surprising effect on observables. A part of this energy is released abruptly and can be captured, I think, with an appropriate equation of state. So if you have dynamical ejecta and you have Latimer-Svesty or Shen EOS, you're going to capture the formation of these seed nuclei, I think. But there's a lot of neutrons left over, and or another example of this is in the mergers, in the merger disks. As they recombine, you can capture that formation of helium through an NSC reaction network. But there's a significant amount of energy that's not released yet, which comes out in the R process. And this requires additional techniques, which hopefully we'll be able to describe and discuss in the discussion section. So these disks that form from mergers viscously spread and cool after they form. Weak freeze-out nuclear recombination begins on the outside of the disk and moves in, and this evaporates these disks, I believe, ejecting a significant fraction of the mass into space. And the R-process heating can have a major effect as matter is expanding to low densities on what returns to the black hole, and this may have observable effects on X-ray flaring from GRBs. And then finally, that the residual decay can continue to heat the ejecta, possibly powering an optical transient. I think this is very important because this, I think, is one of the more promising counterparts to mergers because it can be seen from any viewer angle. And I'll finish there. Thanks.
So I have three questions. The first one is, in your analysis, analytic model, did you treat the Kerr black hole, rotating black hole?
In which model?
In the first part.
The accretion disk model. Yeah, I'm trying to remember what we took. I think we looked at both different radii for the ISCO, which is how we parameterize the rotation of the black hole. Mm-hmm. And most of the dynamics I described, except for the very early phase, didn't depend very sensitively on where the ISCO was. So most of this is happening as the disk is spreading to much larger radii, inner radii.
I see.
Exactly whether the disk is objective at early times, etc., will depend on that, but not the stuff I described later.
And the second question is what determines the time scale between burst and the tail of the light curve of the short gamma ray burst? It depends on m dot, m and alpha parameter or something like that. What is the most important parameter to
determine? In our model or in reality?
In your model.
So this gap that's opened up in the in the fallback is related to the heating time scale for the it's related to as you take matter that's just marginally bound quite bound and push it out and become marginally bound. Mm-hmm. There's a little gap that opens up in the we should talk about this more because it's kind of complicated. But the order of magnitude is that it's related to this heating time scale of one second. It can get somewhat longer if you're right around this transition from the cutoff to the tail. But it's basically related to the fact that the R process takes a few seconds to heat.
And you talked about the gravitational waves, and the light curve, and in the context of multi-messenger astronomy, by comparing the data of gravitational waves and the light curve, can we extract some information of the central ranging?
I mean, I imagine if you detect it, gravitational waves will presumably tell you something about the type of binary that is merging. And our theory tells us, for instance, that higher mass ratio binary should produce more ejecta, which should produce brighter. So you observe this event, you're getting a handle on mostly on how much mass is ejected from the merger. So I guess in an indirect way, that will relate to the binaries. But that's what we need to figure out. That's
this ejecting up to a third of the mass in the disk, what determines that? How should I think of the mass fraction of the disk that's ejected?
Yeah, so it's not obvious it should be so high. You should think of it as it's just something that we found was we found basically it could be from 20 to 50% if we took a disk mass of ranging from maybe a tenth of a solar mass to a thousandth of a solar mass. And it's basically related to the fact that you form a disk at compact radii that's hot and very massive, and as it accretes, it spreads. But the mass of the disk only goes down as radius to the minus one half. So the disk can spread by a factor of say 30, and the mass and then during that time, and the mass will only go down by a factor of square root of that. So when the disk has spread to the point where the recombination begins, it can still have a high fraction of its initial mass. So it's not obvious. It's just related to how hot it is initially, how much it has to spread before recombination begins, and how much mass is accreted up to that point.
A question. Do you need some minimum initial mass in the disk to follow through with this, or does it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we looked at it down to 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. I do think it's possible, because if you make a less massive disk, that's actually a good question. It depends on. I have to think about what the temperature dependence of the disk is in the mass. If the disk temperature was much lower as I lowered the mass, then by the time it spread to these radii, maybe it would still be very bound to the black hole, and that wouldn't be enough energy released.
Is there sort of a rough scaling that you can have in mind as the disk increases how well it works or decreases?
In the cases ranging from what I thought were the range of reasonable values, 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 1, you know, in all cases we found that the recombination was happening at large enough radii that the winds would be ejected, but I don't have a sense for if that would still be valid outside of that mass range. But it should be looked into.
So Do you, well, I don't see some neutrino things here in the conclusions. So do you have some effect from the neutrino emission? I think that neutrino star merger have some neutrino emissions, and then these neutrino spectra may affect the neutron richness, as in a supernovae.
Yes.
So. Okay.
Yeah. So certainly, if one is, so I show that there are three types of mass I think can be ejected. One is matter can be dynamically ejected. So, as Jim originally discussed, so tidal forces during the merger, just you know in milliseconds is ejected, following the final coalescence. The second way is through these disks. The freeze out of these disks occurs at large enough radii that irradiation of the disk by neutrinos from the central source is unimportant if that source of neutrinos is just the disk itself. I calculated this. So, but if there's a central massive neutron star that survives for a second as this freeze-out is occurring, its irradiation of this disk could affect my freeze-out distribution of YE. So that's one place it could be important. The third source of mass ejecta is you can have neutrino winds from the hypermassive neutron star. Generally, this is a somewhat smaller mass, but certainly there the spectrum of the neutrinos is very important for what YE is ejected. And I think you know our wisdom from supernova would say that YE would be much higher because the electron neutrinos don't tend to be significantly different than the antineutrino energies. But so I would expect. My point is that I think there's going to be a wide range of YE ejected in these events. It's going to range all the way from maybe the very cold, low YE stuff detected dynamically up to maybe high YE stuff by the neutrino wind.
So one final question is, on what time scale does the alpha recombination occur? You may have shown that, I just can't recall it. I was wondering whether that's something we could actually do in a full, you know, hydrodynamic simulation with an appropriate EOS.
I certainly think you could. Generally, let me see if I really have it here. Yeah. So, as I said, we didn't really include it here. But if I go and see how long it takes the disk to spread, you know, you could probably choose parameters that, you know. In this case is, you know, 0.3 seconds or 1 second. So it's many, it's just a few viscous times of the initial disk, but many, many dynamical times. So probably 4/alpha. so if you had if you put it an alpha viscosity into your hydrodynamic evolution of the disk, I certainly think this is within range.
So one could in principle do a 2D simulation, have, you know, an inner boundary condition, do, you know, hydro with an alpha viscosity and, you know, Latimer-Swesty EOS, and then you should be seeing that effect.
Yeah, right? this was as I mentioned, this is done, this paper by Lee et al. They did this in two dimensions. They did not follow as far as I can tell, the weak interaction freeze out properly. So they don't have too many great plots in this paper that I was able to show. But they claim that they followed this and saw the helium evaporation, the helium recombination. But they assume that these weak interactions were always enforcing this equilibrium between positron electron captures, which is not becoming valid as the disk is reaching these radii.
So they're just assuming NSE, basically. Not NSE, but beta equilibrium.
Beta equilibrium, yeah. I'm careful to say beta equilibrium, because usually beta equilibrium means you have some neutrinos are also it's a reaction. It's going, you know, the other reaction going the other way is not in balance. It's this versus this. So yeah, limited beta equilibrium. So that should certainly be redone with following this freeze out properly. Because of course, YE indirectly affects, you know, how much fraction of your matter goes into helium, obviously. So that comes into this.
Okay, then let's thank Brian again.